Christmas and Happy New Year to everybody. Christmas came by on Thursday, again Christmas Eve on Wednesday. My family and I were celebrating it on Wednesday. This right now, we just finished our Christmas dinner because they have to go off to everybody else. We need to remember what Christmas is all about, but when we look at Christmas and all the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, November and December, we've got to remember the veterans that are served our nation and the military that are serving all around the world at this time, whether it's in the United States or Iraq, Afghanistan, any place. And before I get started, I'd like to read to begin with here what this is all about, and then we'll move on to our guest. And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was the governor of Syria. And all went to be taxed, every one into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee out of the city of Nazareth into Judea, unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary as his spouse's wife, being with child. And so it was that, while they were there, that the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. And there were at the same time country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flocks by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said to them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be all people. For unto you is born this day, in the city of David, a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you, you shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was an angel with a multitude of heavenly hosts praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, on earth peace, goodwill toward all men. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come to Christmas and we're in the military, it all comes down to peace on earth. And those in the military, unfortunately, wherever they are, whatever they're doing, don't find peace at that given time. And that leaves a real nightmare on our souls and deep in our hearts. So let's have a discussion about that. Ray, are you with us today?
Yes, sir, I am.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Ray Clark. He was with us last month. He has written an incredible book that everybody needs to read. We talked about it again, and we're going to continue to use that book as a foundation for what we're looking with. Let's talk about this. I mean, when we think about it, you were in Vietnam at the worst time, at the worst thing, had some of the worst experiences, and I was in Vietnam and went to Desert Storm. You and I both had experiences, and you write in your book of the fear and everything of what's going on, and you guys are all young puppies, and all of us were there. I mean, around Christmas time, everybody wants to be home, don't they? And unfortunately, they can't be home.
That's true. That's where they depend on mail and packages and, you know, care packages, whatever you want to call them. Just connecting with people you love. And, you know, the thing about it is, Doug, is you have joined another family. So now you have two families. You're with one of them in Vietnam or wherever you might be, and then your other family is back home. And both of them are very important to you. In Vietnam, because we were up on the DMZ, we knew that when they had a stand down or a peace, you know, a time to have peace around the holidays, the North Vietnamese never got the word to do that, many units of them. So you could never really let all your guard down, and there wasn't a whole lot of parties going on or anything else. So, you know, it came and passed, and, you know, through the mail and things like that, we had our Christmas. Maybe you get a fruitcake or something in the mail, but and people would share it with you. So it wasn't really a big deal as far as where I was at in Vietnam. I'm sure people had better experiences. But, you know, it depends where your loved one's at. Sometimes, even today, they can't reach them because they don't know where they are. So they have to, you know, make do with what they have. And, you know, it's like you said in the very beginning of the program, and I appreciate that. It's not our birthday, and it's not our celebration, and we're supposed to be celebrating something bigger than that, you know, Christ's birth. But a lot of times we get caught into the hoopla, and we forget what day it is. If I don't get what I want, then I get hurt. were upset. But, yeah, the poor guy out there on the field, he just wants to get through the day without getting himself hurt. So I'm sure yours was different from mine, but it was still not being with your family. So family is very important.
It's such a painful experience because, I mean, as I wrote about and I shared with you, I mean, back in Christmas, both 1969 and 1970, you know, they all said there was a stand down in bombing. Well, we didn't have a stand down in bombing. And I mean, right. I flew combat bombing missions on Christmas, even Christmas Day in those years.
Wow.
And that whole thing there, we're looking, I mean, what this is really about is just that it's Christ's birthday. And all of us were raised with that, where we went to church on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, or usually both cases, and to celebrate, and we're singing hymns of praise and everything else and understanding what it is, and then we're getting together with family.
Right.
You know, your whole concept, and this is what you've said throughout your book and what you've said to me since we've met, and I understand, your military buddies are your family, a family right. beyond any comprehension, because you're living and dying for each other.
That's right.
And what you do together depends on how whether you're going to survive or be injured or anything else. So, I mean, the reliance on each of us in combat or in the military is staggering.
That's true.
You know, it's totally different. So as you said, you have two families. I mean, I got my family right here, part of it anyway. And we've had a good Thanksgiving or Christmas dinner. We had Thanksgiving dinner and Christmas dinner once, and we do a Christmas dinner again today. But we have all of our, as we got older, all of our kids, and they got their own families, and then they have together with the other parts of their spouse's family. And so it's rare today with such an extended family where you're going to have everybody in one place at one time, isn't it?
That's true. That's true. It's hard to get them all together. You know, when I came back from Vietnam, I came back before Christmas, and my platoon had been wiped out just in September, latter part of September. And so when I came back, I was lacking that other part. It was seemed as though I lost all my friends in one day. And, you know, I was having to bear that grief alone. I couldn't share it with anybody. I couldn't wreck their Christmas. And so a lot of times there's a lot of pressure put on the veterans to celebrate. Or I read Ruth Crocker's, some of what she'd written in that book she's written, Those Who Remain. And she was talking about the sense of loss that a lot of veterans feel because of their friends. But then when they come to Christmas, it's an overwhelming sense of expectation that really requires them to act as normal as possible. And that's pretty heavy sometimes to the veteran. You know, people want him to act happy and go to parties and meet people, and everybody wants to laud him. And he's living. You don't know where his mind is. It could be back in Iraq or Afghanistan with his friends or grieving over certain things. So I think, you know, we have to be conscious of that when we have veterans in the family. You know, not to pamper them, but really just to be there with a soft shoulder maybe and help them to get through the holidays.
Yeah, I think what's so strange, and I found this, I mean, from a veteran from multiple wars and doing all kinds of things in buku years, I'm not any good at small talk, so if I go to a party or out to a bar with a group of people and they got this all the small talk about sports or something or the weather, well, my mindset is in a totally different world. I mean, you know, when right. I started out the show, you know, on Peace on Earth, I mean, man, that's where it's really at for the warrior. I mean, you know, myself yeah. and others, we really do want peace on Earth, but at the same time, you're involved in something that you can't get out of. And so you got this dichotomy. You were raised with all these hopes, these ambitions for yeah. peace on Earth. And here on Christmas, you can't get out of it. You're in the middle of a firefight. I mean,
exactly. Yes, exactly right.
Totally
and, you know, these guys tell me nowadays when they come home from Iraq and Afghanistan, they can be driving down the highway and see a dead animal on the side of the road, and they have a panic attack because they've seen them where they use them for IEDs. So he's living in a totally different world mentally, and to try to force him into situations like big crowds and things like this, He's been programmed to stay away from big crowds. That's where bad things happen. Or, people have a lot of alcohol at parties, and people get loose-mouthed and loose-tongued, and first thing you know, you've got a lot of problems. So you have to kind of have parties and such of realizing you got veterans there that are still dealing with post-war problems. And if we understand that, we'll be able to adapt to it and still have a good time.
But I think then that doesn't go away, and that's, I think, your book, The Never-Ending War.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I were over there. I mean, that's 1969, 1970,
yeah.
1971. I mean, that's well over 40 years ago.
Yeah, long time.
Yeah, and yet that's it's as if it happened yesterday. And then when you get to Desert Storm, it's as if it happened yesterday. And the bond that I created with those individuals, I mean, I've got a bond with my sergeant and others.
Right.
We're so tight that, and Denise Nichols, the co-host of the show, who's off doing Christmas stuff today with her family.
Right.
We're so tight that there's a bond there beyond any sense of imagination. It's greater than a blood of birth. It's far greater than anything.
That's right.
And then you have that concern for their health and safety. I mean, when we took off and it's still there, I mean, and I wrote about it, you know, when we took off on a bombing mission on Christmas Eve, here we're going into doing something that we just prayed about not to happen.
Right.
We're with just a handful of people. We're singing Silent Night as we go in, do our bombing, and come out and sing Silent Night again. Talk about messing with the psyche forever and ever and ever.
Yeah, I think what you have to do is you come down to the fact is, I heard a great martial artist, and I've studied martial arts for 23 years, but he said one time, he said, we help people who deserve it, and we kill people who deserve it. And so it was one of those things of where the enemy was really hurting a lot of people. They were causing a lot of bad things to happen, and we were trying to stop that. We were the other side of having peace. Sometimes you have to have someone to stand up and say, that's it, no more. And, they are peacemakers, but they come in different flavors like that. We were fighting to have peace, but we were the very unfortunate ones that had to go out there and stop the bad guy. And they're going to be bad guys as long as the world is around. And these guys over in Iraq and Afghanistan and wherever they may be in this world, in Africa and different places, they're fighting that we don't even know they're there. They are peacemakers. They are keeping them out of this country so we can have our malls and our shopping days and our celebrations and all those things. You can't go anywhere in the world and have that kind of peace that we do in America. And I think it's because of our military, we have that luxury. So they're just paying the price of doing that, I think.
You know, I think what you're bringing up this, Ray, and I'd like to cordially disagree to some extent.
Sure.
Because, you know, when we went into Vietnam, okay, we know today that the Gulf of Tonkin incident didn't happen and all that stuff didn't take place. So that was all fraudulent to begin with. You know, and the domino theory didn't happen. It didn't take place at all. And then we went over to Iraq for Desert Storm, and again, all that thing was a makeshift thing. And then we got Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, which are all makeshift things. So when we talk about, and I understand the military, and I've got this thing where I go back and forth in it. Well, we're going over there fighting them to prevent them from coming here. Well, they have no way to come here. They have no Air Force. They have no Navy. They have no transportation. For the most part, those people don't have any concept or any idea outside of a area maybe 20 miles around them radius, because that's where their life exists. And yet we're in there saying this, and then you got the veteran that comes back and says, now, wait a minute, what is the reality here and what is happening? So here's this idea where we're made peace on earth, and yet we're involved in a war in an area with people that have no concept and idea, and all they want to do is be left alone.
That's
for
true.
Resources, because when you look at history and the history of the military and history of war, for our nation, for any other nation, what it's been is like who can control the territory to control the resources. And those resources, in the end, don't belong to any one of us. They belong to God. And, you know, so, like, what's right and what's wrong there? And that's, I think, true. That part for me, that dichotomy, which I'm trying to describe, I mean, that hurts deep in the soul. I mean, what is right and what is wrong? And yet, right. Christmas time, your brain is scrambled.
True. I mean, you're right. You know, I guess it would be the difference of having, you know, you're privy to knowing certain information. Now, when I went to Vietnam, I was a grunt. I was probably the last guy on the totem pole. We didn't ask. We weren't told. We were there to do a certain job, and that's all our world kind of contained. The more you begin, I think, the Bible says with much knowledge comes much grief. And so as you learned a lot of these things, Doug, I wasn't privy to them. So you learned them, and you could see the hypocrisy of what was going on. I didn't realize that until later in life, and some of it came about when you and I met and began to talk. So, you know, a lot of times the poor guy that's out there doing a job or out there fighting the enemy, he doesn't understand all the politics and all the things that's being played out. Most wars start because two people can't get along, and they send 2 million people to fight each other. We used to joke that we were killing people we weren't even mad with, and that's the way life is. But, it's always been the soldier is the last one to find out. There's always a political maneuvering around him, and we were just sent in to do a job, and that's mine was not to question why. Mine was to do or die. That was kind of a...
Yeah, we need to remember right there, Joe Cocker did die this last week, a great,
right.
great musician and an individual that was involved in war protests and everything. I don't know if you saw that in the news. He was.
I did, yes, sir.
I mean, that's a great loss. I mean, he did have that ballad or anthem, I guess, during the Vietnam War, didn't he?
Right. Yes, he did. Yeah, it did. People were trying to serve their country in a lot of different ways, and they didn't agree with the war, and they saw a lot of things that maybe other people didn't see. The war had a strange twist of where they couldn't change the politics or the politicians, so they started trying to attack the military during those years. And, we all understand what took place there. Sometimes they were... I think it was Miss Fonda. Somebody said talked about building a backfire like you would in a forest fire, where you're trying to burn a fire out with a fire. All these type of things, but it was sometimes it comes down to the poor guy out there in the bush, and he's the one that's catching all the flack, and he doesn't even know why. We found weapons, and I talked about it in the book, that had plates on those that said. Donated by a certain American university. And the fact was that university was buying weapons, or not buying weapons, but sending money to the North Vietnamese as a humanitarian gesture for them to buy food and medical supplies. But they were flaunting the fact through those plates on the rifles that they were buying weapons through those donations. So, and that kind of hits you between the eyes, too, of realizing that your own countrymen were supporting the enemy and trying to put that fire out or trying to end the war. So, there's a lot of emotions, a lot of things that come out of somebody going into combat when you realize that you're being palmed or something, or you're out there fighting a war that doesn't even deserve being fought.
It's such a problem. You talked about it in your book, and you mentioned it again today, that in September of 1969, all hell broke loose around you.
Right.
And could you tell the listeners what happened on that day or that during that week?
On September 15th, 1969, we were operating on a ridge line called Mutter's Ridge. It ran within about 500 yards from the DMZ itself, and it was... totally an enemy-held territory. We were in there to find out why they were, gathering up in that area, what was going on. And my company of originally 203 Marines had been on that operation for about 2 weeks. We had taken a lot of casualties because we were in enemy territory. And on September 15th, my platoon of 48 Marines was told to go to the largest hill on that ridgeline, which was Hill 410. And when we went over there, we knew we were going to hit some kind of opposition because the enemy had been there during that week. We knew it because we could hear them shooting at planes. And as our air wing would drop bombs on them, they would still be shooting at them with small arm fire. So we knew they were there. Well, the Marine Corps or whoever was in charge was anticipating that the enemy would move on inside the DMZ to keep from having a head-on fight because of our air wing was so powerful. And they weren't really scared of the Marine ground troops as much as they were the support system that we had. So anyway, they were assuming they would move. And what they didn't realize, it was a full moon that week. So the enemy couldn't move in the daytime because we were bombing them. And at night, Puff the Magic Dragon and different air support systems were flying around, and they would have spotted them moving. So what they did was they just hunkered down. They built an ambush. They waited for us, and then when we went over there, we walked into an ambush, and out of 48 Marines, we came out. We took 42 casualties over there. I was one of
48,
six Marines.
48 individuals and 42 casualties?
Yeah. We had originally about six dead, and the rest of them were badly wounded. There was a couple of them that did die from that, and so there was that much more. But I was a squad leader, and I had five men left in my squad, and that's what came out of that. During the operation, out of 203, we ended up with 137 Marines. So we took a lot of casualties. We lost several corpsmen during that operation. It was a bad time. It really was.
And it seems like, you write as a memory, and you write in your book and our conversations,
yeah.
You talk as if it happened yesterday. Is that, I know from my own experience, that's calm, it isn't. When you've been involved in combat or involved in an operation, the memory of that operation or that engagement or whatever it is seems to reside in your soul for eternity.
It really does. It's hard to get away from it because there's so many triggers and there's so many memories. I would go hunting years later. I would go hunting, but I would begin to think about the enemy behind trees and stuff, and I would have to come out of the woods. I used to love to bear hunt and deer hunt and all those type of things, but it got so stressful that I couldn't do it anymore. And the reason being because when you're out there in the woods and just before it starts getting dark, you can hear things walking out in the woods or, limbs cracking and different things. And suddenly I'd be back in Vietnam, and I would have to get up and go home. It never goes away, Doug. It's always the never-ending war. Colonel Oliver North told me one time when I'd written this book, he said, Ray, he said, the name of your book is the most amazing name. He said, you couldn't have picked a better name because it never goes away. It is there constantly. And it will follow you home from the war. And when you come home, I wrote in my book about when I first came home, Doug, I ended up realizing that I had to live two lives. I had to look normal on the outside as much as possible, and I would be living in grief and anguish on the inside and really hoping for a shorter life and a sooner death. I really did not want to live to be old because I was hurting so bad. And I think a lot of veterans are there. I think a lot of them come home with that kind of anguish. And when they get back home and they realize some of the things that went on, like you talk about, it just makes you look like you were tricked into going and you were there doing taking all this hits emotionally for nothing. It was just a political thing that was going on, and they could have solved it a lot of different ways. But these guys come back home and they realize it was not what they thought it was. They weren't fighting evil. They were actually trying to get a better oil supply or whatever the cause was. We found out a lot of things when we came home.
That's one of the things that happened to do it. Around Christmas, again, Thanksgiving for me personally, as we've talked about this, and I think you can understand this is one of the reasons where I kind of like, and there's a bond here or something that's happening. I'm not sure why or how or where it's going. But me for Thanksgiving, I mean, I went to Vietnam for the second time at Thanksgiving in 1969.
Right.
Just hours after I found out my grandma had died. Mm-hmm. And then I went over to Desert Storm on Thanksgiving in 1990 again. Here we go again.
Yeah.
And then obviously having spent two Christmases in Vietnam where I did get to see Bob Hope. I really did. I mean, I was right up in the front rows there with him. You know, flight crews, we could push up and get our way right up in the front, you know. Rank and job did have meaning.
Oh, yeah, I know it did. Well, I almost saw Bob Hope one time. When I had malaria, I was on the USS Sanctuary for about a week or a week and a half, and they told me that Bob Hope was doing a show up on top of the top deck. And so I had malaria, and I mean, I was sick as a dog, but I climbed those steps, and I drug myself. And when I got to the top where he was, I saw the helicopter leaving the ship. So I saw him fly away. So I never got to see the show.
Yeah, I think what was strange, and when I was when I saw him in Utapau twice, 69 and 70, everybody came in, and this was really unique. And I think it's a change in time and the individuals. Everybody came in and sat down. And everybody sat down and got involved in the show. When we went to Desert Storm and I saw Bob Hope at Eskan Village in Riyadh, and that's where the command headquarters was. So, I mean, he put a show on, I get maybe 500 yards away from the command headquarters staff where we were at for, you know, the command staff. And everybody got in there, and even though Bob Hope and everybody asked everybody to sit down, please sit down, the guys didn't sit down.
Wow.
And so it made it very difficult to see the show, and it was a thing almost as if etiquette had disappeared.
Right.
I look at the tapes of the Bob Hope show from Vietnam, and I've got all of the tapes. He came out with a VHS set some years ago. I got it at Fort McClellan, Alabama, and it was totally, totally different. And I'm not sure, I mean, you have an attitude of individual respect and individual caring that was really really tight in Vietnam and up to the last few years. And then all of a sudden you saw this individualism, I mean, really severe individualized thoughts and actions take over in the military. But you write about that in your book with the newbies and everything else, and all of a sudden it became clear when I'm thinking about it.
Right.
Really don't want to have friends, because if you know you're going to war and you're going into a battle where the probability is you're going to get shot or killed, you don't want to have somebody else to love to worry about, do you?
No, you don't. You want it as carefree as possible. You don't want any that's where you don't need a lot of problems back home. People write their veterans, and they tell them all the problems and all the stuff, and you don't realize you're adding grief into his life. And he doesn't want to be there. He wants to come home and help you fix the problems. So you got to be careful what you write. I got a Dear John in Vietnam, and there were a lot of my buddies that got Dear Johns, but it came from a girl who was going to college, and she told me that she was kind of living like a living in hypocrisy. I could not get it out. And she said, all my friends were opposed to the war, and here I am writing you all the time. And it was like, and so I wrote her back and told her, look, I'll see you when I get home. I appreciate it, but I really didn't need that much in my mind as far as her. And so I cut the strings loose, and I was able to function even better because I could keep my mind on staying alive and not on some frivolous matter at home.
I think that's a big difference between, and we talked about this before, back in the Vietnam, we did have one way of communicating. It was called the Mars Network.
Right.
And the Mars Network was basically shortwave radio guys transmitting a message so you could get a line out, but it'd be like a radio call, and you're going over, and then the other person's got to go over, and all that back and forth.
Right.
But the communications was strictly by U.S. mail, and the mail, I know, I had one. I mean, it was months old before the time that I got it and anything. But the communications weren't there. Today, you got instant communications. So we got guys in the middle of a battle with a cell phone, and they could call home and say, you know, okay, hi, what is going on?
I saw in a Marine Corps magazine, I saw a cartoon with a Marine standing behind the wall, and the caption said, Mom, I've been separated from my company. Can you look on CNN and tell me where they are? So that was kind of a joke kind of thing, but it was a little bit of the truth, too, because the world has gotten so small through the communications and the social medias and stuff. It's amazing. We didn't have that kind of stuff. We had we had dumb weapons. We had our claymores that had on the front of it, front point toward enemy, and it was like that was kind of a joke for everybody. But I'm glad they have all the communications today and all the stuff they have, and the squad leaders have a computer and they can they have drones that they can fly around and see where the enemy is. All those things are better than what it used to be.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean combat operations are better or the outcomes are better, because it comes down to the fundamental thing. You're going to shoot that enemy, and the enemy's going to shoot you, and you've got to stay alive and get taken care of.
That's exactly right.
I mean, you know, one of the things that bothers me today, they got all these radios and all this stuff, and we ran into this problem. In Vietnam, and again where I was before, and the time I spent 3 years in the infantry, and I was a combat medic, you didn't carry a whole lot of junk because you didn't have room to carry. And now you look at these guys, and you talked in your book when you were maneuvering, you're carrying 80 pounds of junk.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, wait a minute, what am I going to do? And then when I come back to the world and we see today, you see the police trying to mimic the military, you know, when they're doing their SWAT and tactic operations. And so they got all this junk and hanging on to them, and I'm going to go, wait a minute, you're going up with bad guys.
Yeah.
And you can't get down in the dirt and dig a hole because you got so much junk hanging on you, you look like a Christmas tree.
Exactly.
I mean, there's something wrong with this. And then you have all the spinal cord. I got that problem. All the guys got spinal cord injuries.
That's right.
Both the lumbar, thoracic, and the cervical spine because of all this junk. So, I mean,
sometimes
the technology comes, but the technology doesn't necessarily make it better.
Well, that's true. That's true. And I guess that's why they want young men that can do shoulder some of this stuff, because older guys couldn't do it. After we were lost my platoon, we had to carry the weapons for that platoon. There was only six of us, so we had to carry the weapons for 48 of them. And we all of us had six weapons apiece and different things. And I put in the book, I said, we'd probably get killed trying to figure out which rifle to shoot because we had our hands full of them. But we did have to have that precarious situation until we stopped that night and got rid of those weapons. But sometimes you can get overextended on some of that stuff, and you're right. I mean, these guys get confused. It comes down to who's got the rifle, who pulls the trigger first, and you've got to have your mind on that. I don't know how they function carrying 100 pounds of gear with them.
Yeah, I don't know. The other thing, too, when I get this, everybody keeps talking about, well, let's put some more lights in for security. Let me tell you, to this day, I don't want lights around me because I see far better in the dark if I don't have any lights and if I got bright lights shining here and there than anything, and I can't figure that out. Well, yeah, make your safe, put some lights on. Well, you know, hey, I don't want the lights on because I can't see. I can adjust and I can adapt. I can see anything and everything.
Yeah.
Once my eyes adapt. And so, I mean, here's this dichotomy again. This is what, you know, the common thought is today. And for us, that common thought is, I'm not going to go anywhere near there. That's a death trap.
Exactly. Well, you know, we lived in an armed society that they're getting ready and they're preppers and all this kind of thing. And we that have been in combat know that there's one part of combat that most people in America have never seen, and that's when your aggressor comes after you. When he shoots at you, the whole world changes real quick. And most people, if you've never been trained to fight an enemy and train how to go after him when he attacks, you're going to be a victim. You're going to be victimized because you're going to hesitate. A lot of good people are carrying weapons today, but they will hesitate because they don't want to ruin their lifestyle by pulling the trigger. In hunting, they always say the fun ends when you pull the trigger. Now you've got something else to do. You got to clean the kill and all this kind of stuff.
You know, I think with the Vietnam vet and probably some to this extent today, that willingness that we all developed, that we all got inbred into us, really can eat with you, because you realize what power you have over life and death and what you're willing to do, because we were put into a situation where we had to do it. There were no choices or no options.
You're right.
But you've hit the depth of the soul on the realization of what we're capable of doing under the worst of the worst situations.
Yeah, the thing about America is it's like the Disney World of the world. Nowhere in this world is like America, I don't think. And, you know, they're busy having their Christmas parties and going to the malls and all these type of things. Everybody got a cell phone in their face and they're texting and all this stuff. When you come back from a third world country, whether it's Vietnam or Afghanistan or whatever it is, you have been among people who daily survive. They eat, they sleep, they do everything standing guard, more or less, because it's so much friction around the world that most countries are in battle somewhere. Well, when you come back here, you realize that America are the most vulnerable people around, because they've never been in those situations. And so the veteran comes back, he's going to be in a full mode of he will sit at a table with his back to the wall. He will be careful about crowds. He don't want to be around a lot of noise. He don't want to be around a lot of things going on around him. You probably had the same problem, Doug. I don't like to be in noisy situations and crowds and things like that. And he's expected to just fall right back into place, and he can't do it because he is on full alert. And that was one of the problems we had in Vietnam. When we came back home, it was hard to get off of alert. It was hard to dummy down and just act normal. And so to this day, I still sit at tables with my back to the wall. It's just I feel comfortable. And I am hypervigilant.
I think all vets do that. I mean, you know, I've got to scan the room and everybody else. You know, then I had law enforcement training, too, and hang around those guys.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I went out to lunch with one of the police lieutenants a while ago. We were doing a play and getting ready for a play. And both, we went into a restaurant that both of us knew. We both liked to go there. We both were in there, and both of us tried to have it at our this one seat where our back was up against the wall.
Right.
You know, and there was only two places, you know, and then I had to relinquish to him because, well, he was the active duty police lieutenant.
Yeah, the gun.
You know, and he's looking, and we're both looking around us, and lo and behold, one of the bad guys came in.
Yeah, well, you know, and I've studied martial arts, Okinawan Shotoryu, for 20-some years, and all that, you practice being hypervigilant about being, you know, everything around you, you know what's in the room, you know what's available to you to help you in any situation. So, you know, my life has been wrapped up in since I was, 18 years old, has been practicing hypervigilance. So, when, you know, I just want people to understand, when your veteran comes home from a third world country or wherever they've been, they might not even be able to tell you where they've been, but you'll know it because you can look in their eyes and see a difference. There's a little bit of light has gone out in their eyes or something. There's a little bit of sadness that comes along with it. And this is one of the highest suicide times of the year, Doug. And there's been over 200,000 Vietnam veterans that have committed suicide.
How many?
Well, they say between 200,000 and 250,000.
I mean, the numbers that are supposedly, as reports, official reports, that are committing suicide today is in the dozens right now, isn't it?
42 a day is what they say.
42 a day?
And Christmas is one of the bad times because there's so much spending, there's so much drinking, there's so much stuff going on, and alcohol does cause people to let down their guard, and they get jealous, they get angry, there's a lot of, you know, I talked about in the book that after my platoon was wiped out and everything, my company got wiped out, when I went to another unit, they went to a place for 3 days, and we weren't supposed to be seen in 3 days without a beer in each hand. That was the only time in Vietnam I really got plastered. And I crawled up under a house or a building, and I cried. That was the first time I had cried, but I was so full of grief and anger and all these things, guilt, everything else, that's how it came out. And it was through the drugs and alcohol that happened. Now, when you get guys back from a war zone, there's going to be something in there that they can't tell you. One of the things my book has done it's helped families to realize what these guys have been experiencing, whether it was Vietnam or the day. War is war. The terrain may be different, but it's still war and people dying and things like that. But the book has helped a lot of families to realize where that guy has been and what he's experienced and what it says what he can't say. And so it's become a voice for a lot of veterans. And their families have realized that, okay, we're going to have to adjust some things and help this guy to readjust, refocus.
Now, one thing, again, at Christmas time and everything else, when we see this stuff and you go to church,
yeah,
I know for me personally, I mean, at the end of the Bob Hope shows, I saw them three times, they get the entire cast and everybody's up there singing Silent Night together.
Right.
And
that's wonderful.
I mean, it's there, but at the same time, to this day, when I go to church and no matter where I am, and when I hear Silent Night or sing Silent Night, it has an entirely different meaning for me,
right,
than it does for anybody else because of those experiences.
Sure.
And there's, I mean, you can look at the tapes and look at it and review it and all the stuff that's been done in history, and you see joy and fear and tears and love all at the same time in your soul.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to deal with. I mean, when you're looking at Christmas and all this stuff is there, you want to be with your family and you can't be with your family. You don't want to go into a crowd, but you're expected to go into crowds.
Exactly.
Everybody's out there drinking, have a hard time. I mean, any veteran I know, if you're on any medications at all or any of this stuff, I mean, you shouldn't be drinking alcohol whatsoever.
Exactly.
Because that's just going to aggravate the situation.
That's true.
And if you're taking any special meds because of your injuries or wounds, you have to be careful on what you're eating and drinking at the same time. But then when you hit this dichotomy and all these emotions are swelling up, I mean, the first thing one person wants to do is grab an alcohol or some illegal drugs or take their more than their prescribed amount of legal
right.
drugs that they're getting from the doctor. And all this just creates a nightmare, doesn't it?
It really does. And on my website, theneverendingwar.com, and it's under L.M. Clark, I put something on there about suicide, how to spot somebody who is contemplating suicide. And it has signs of a suicidal person. It has a way to help the suicidal person to stop and think. There's certain signs on there. And when you've got someone who has been dealing with this kind of stuff, post-traumatic stress or whatever it is, you can look in their eyes a lot of times and you can see a lot of things going on. But if they are on medications and they are drinking, and people will prompt them to do those type of things because they want them to fit them in and they want them to have a happy time. But a lot of times like that doesn't end up happy. It ends up somebody going to jail because domestic violence is prevalent among veterans. The divorce rate with Vietnam veterans was 94%. And I've known veterans that have been married 8 and 9 times. So I believe what you're seeing today is the grandchildren of a lot of these Vietnam veterans, but they've been raised in those type of atmospheres, and so it's going to be passed on to their families. And we just have to be conscious, Doug, that these guys are hurt, they're hurting, and they're going to continue to hurt, and we have to learn ourselves how to cope with their problems, not to cater to them more or less, but just be there. They want to feel welcome. They want to feel like they're welcome home. They want to be at peace with everything and everybody. They want to have some good food, all those type of things. But they don't need to be interrogated at some of these parties. They don't need a lot of noise and a lot of calamity going on around them. And they don't need to be told constantly they're a hero, because they might not be. But expect them to be a little bit away from crowds and excessive everything.
You just mentioned that, and I know the same thing. And I mean, I know individuals by their actions definitely were heroes, okay?
Oh, sure, right.
But this whole concept that just because you're in the military, you're a hero, or just because you went to this engagement, you're a hero, to me is so weird and so foreign that it doesn't make any friggin' sense at all. I mean, it's like, wait a minute. All we did was do our job, and all we're trying to do now is finish your job. That's not a hero. That's just somebody doing a job, period.
Warrior. And, you know, it started with political correctness of where everybody gets a trophy and everybody gets a ribbon and everybody, there's no losers. Well, you come out of combat like that, and probably the guy who's the most heroic would be the last one to tell you. He always gives credit to somebody else. And we used to say all of our heroes were dead. And I didn't want to be a hero because they were all dead, you know. And today, you look in the sports arenas and places like that, I heard someone say, let all your heroes be dead, because if they're alive, they'll disappoint you. And that is the truth a lot of times. So we don't need all these heroes. What we need is to be appreciative for their sacrifices. And those sacrifices will continue on for the rest of their lives, many of them. So they do need to get help. They need to have support. They need to go to the VA and try to get help if they can, or wherever they need to go. But, you know, that's what family is for. I say in the book that three things really kept me all these years, Doug. The Lord saved me, one thing, back in 1980. He forgave me of what I was living with, and he gave me some peace I never had before. The other thing was I had a good family, and my children, my wife and I have seven children. Five of them are hers and two of them are mine, but now we're all together. And we had a great family, and they've been very supportive of me, even though they didn't understand post-traumatic stress. And the other thing was the VA has helped me tremendously. Now, they do make mistakes? Yes, they do. Are they overwhelmed? Yes, they are. So I expect those things, and I try to be appreciative to them, but I also want to receive help when I deserve it and need it. And there's nothing wrong for asking for help when you do deserve and need it. So I would just encourage everybody to love on your veterans and avoid substance use or abuse if possible. And just have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. You know, a DWI will cost you about $10,000 now, from what they say. That's going into debt really bad for something you don't get anything out of.
I mean, you know, again, I quit drinking so many years ago, I couldn't understand why would I pay to pee. You know, why am I going to pay to pee?
Well, it cleans out your system, you know.
You know, and everything else, because it didn't do any good. And, I mean, there's so much in life. I mean, the veterans comes back, and he has an entirely different mindset. I mean, he obviously has to go back and get a good education,
right,
get the training, so both, you know, academic education, vocational training to get a good job.
That's right.
But their contributions that they can make if they get that academic and vocational training, for me, is just staggering. Because I think you told me once before, you wrote in your book, that you quit high school to go in the Marines. But yet, I mean, now look at this. You're a consultant. You've written a book, and you're...
Yeah. You know, and I did finish high school, but, you know, I tell people as a joke that I was in the top 10% of the lower one-third of my class. And that was probably... It's a joke, but it's not that funny sometimes, you know, so... When you're in the top 10% of the lower one-third, that means you're in the crowd that's always in trouble and doing stuff. And you know, I could always pretty much pull off a test. But there was a lot of contributing factors in my life as far as growing up, and you know some of those though you read the book. And people's lives are determined a lot of times by the situations, but you can take a control of this thing. You can force yourself on in and go to college and get an education and doing things. And I am really honored today, Doug, that you would even talk to me. I've had to push and fight for life over the last 40-some years. And I feel like I've accomplished certain goals. I've created products in my life that sold in almost 50 countries. I've done different things, you know, that I was proud of. And I'm a fifth-degree black belt in the martial arts and in the Hall of Fame and all this stuff. And
I mean, that's incredible. What is the Martial Arts Hall of Fame? There's a picture in your book where you were inducted. What is that?
That's right. Well, it was up in Pennsylvania, and it is an organization, the Eastern Martial Arts Organization, and someone will put them in for it, and they scrutinize them, and then they bring them into they have a big ceremony, And it's just a big time, and it goes real good in your resume if you want one, but it don't mean nothing. You're just old, and they do it to get rid of you probably, but other than that, it's all right. So, but, you know, learning the martial arts was one of my coping skills because it was Japanese martial arts. It's Okinawan. So the Japanese Army in World War II studied Okinawan Shorinryu Karate because of the major parts of the philosophy of the martial art is you never give up. It's a shame to give up. You don't deserve to live if you give up. And that's why the Japanese were so cruel to prisoners, and that's why they would kill themselves. I think on Tarawa there was like 3,500 of them, and they ended up with 17 prisoners. And because all of them had either been killed or they killed themselves rather than give up to a, you know, to the United States or whoever they were fighting. They just, it was so much shame involved. But that's helped me along too. One of the great masters said, and I put that in the book, but he said one time, with ability, you must learn humility. And the way he said it was, the stalk that bends the lowest has the most rice on it. And, you know, it's some beautiful things in the martial arts, and I've always enjoyed it. I grow bonsai trees, and I teach that and stuff. And so I've had a lot of great things in my life where people seem to enjoy it and people got a lot of things out of it. And today I encourage these veterans to at least consider bonsai because it's a miniature tree, but it's living art. It's like painting a picture. And on my website, I've got a couple trees on there now, and there's some more pictures coming. But if you get a chance, look at them because they're beautiful trees.
You and know, I think when it comes down to it again at Christmas for the veteran, the whole key thing is give the gift to themselves. Go out there and get their education, get involved in things, find something that you can love where you can contribute, go out there to help the other veterans.
Exactly.
Because when it all comes down, push and shove, if we don't help each other and take care of each other, which is what this is really, Christmas is really about.
Right.
I mean, we don't have anything, and that's the best way to grow and expand and see life change.
Yeah, you'd like to look back in life and see something that you've done that helped somebody else. And, I mean, that's what life is about raising family and helping people and accomplishing certain things. And you never know what you can do until you try. And you always have to try. The Marine Corps taught us that when the enemy attacks, you attack the enemy. And when you've got post-traumatic stress and the mind is telling you to sit down and go to sleep and just lay there and play dead and all these things, you have to get yourself up. You have to make yourself get up, and then you have to go out. Just like you said, community colleges are willing to help you out. The universities are willing to help you out. There's so many things in life you can do that you don't have to fall into a certain mold. You don't have to depend on the VA to get you through life.
I mean, that's the thing. It's individual responsibility and accepting the help that's out there to be offered because, I mean, I've been a teacher and taught at all different levels from kindergarten through graduate school and obviously in the military. And one thing I learned, everybody can achieve excellence and everybody can excel. They need to find what their niche is and go out there and do it.
Exactly. A lot of time is finding a niche. We have a bakery. My wife and I had a bakery for many years, and my wife was an expert at everything she did. And I loved art, so I went into business with her. I ended my business and joined hers, and I was in the art department. And we had a lot of military coming in there trying to get, you know, wedding cakes, and they always wanted this bridal couple to go on top of their cake with the guy's uniform, and, you know, nobody had anything. So I said, well, let me look at it. So I found this particular couple that was already made. It was made of acrylic. And I broke them apart, and I recarved his uniform or made him a uniform. And, Doug, a lot of this thing was done with a one-hair brush under a microscope and magnifying glasses. But I did every ribbon, every medal in that uniform, his badges, his rank, his whatever it was, hair color, eye color, flower color, you know, for the bride, all these things. It made a great service to the military because it was something they didn't have. And then we had other products. My wife made garters for the bride, Air Force, Army, Marine Corps, whatever it was. We made a lot of products that made them a nice wedding for our military.
Yeah, well, Ray, we're about out of time here. Again, Ray Clark, your book is The Never Ending War, and that's available at Amazon and bookstores, and also the you got a website, theneverendingwar.com, correct?
Yes, sir. That's true.
Well, you know, again, it's been a very interesting conversation. Let's continue the ideas to help vets. And, I mean, when I ran across you and find out your efforts and what you plan to do and how you're doing it, I'm going, this is really, really good.
I appreciate it, Doug. I do.
Ladies and gentlemen, again, Merry Christmas, a Happy New Year. If you have any ideas, please give us a call. I mean, our producers have got incredible ideas. We've got somebody we're working on right now. Ray and I have been in contact with him. Somebody else that's out there making incredible, incredible differences. And we're going to continue to do this, continue to help. Gary Knoll, Merry Christmas. Everybody at Progressive Radio Network, PRN, Merry Christmas, and thank you very much. Ray, Merry Christmas to you and your wife.
Oh, Merry Christmas to you too, Doug, and your family. And I hope you have a wonderful new year.
Okay, thank you very much, and Merry Christmas and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you so much, Doug. I enjoyed it, and I appreciate it.